Good evening, one and all. Yes, another week, another book and a chat. Goes very quickly, doesn't it? I was just talking to my guests. We actually had a almost autumnal bit of weather today. It was about 35, bit of light frost this morning, Connecticut. And it was, you know, not too bad during the day. But then the forecast for the next couple of days is 70 degrees, 80 degrees for the weekend. Yeah, it's October nearly. Come on, give us a bit of a break. It is the first day of autumn, I believe, today, if I remember right as well. Anyway, my guest, well, what is he? He is a playwright. He is an author. He is an actor. He was worked in the news, in the press and stuff like that. And he is on this show. He also, I must admit, is one of the few Americans who knows what a good Lancashire hot pot is. But that's giving a bit of away, haven't I? Anyway, on this show, I better introduce him, haven't I? Because on this show today, I have the one and only M.L. Huey, or as I'm going to call him, Michael. Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Barry. Thank you so much.
Yes. First of all, I better explain to people, Lancashire hot pot dish specialised in Lancashire in England, compared to Yorkshire pudding, which is the other side of the Pennines up there, the white and the red roses. And you know, spend a lot of time in England and stuff like that, so you do actually know what I'm talking about when it comes to that delicacy, shall I say.
Yes, I have had Lancashire hot pot, which I guess for Americans is probably closer to what we would call a stew.
Yeah.
Sort of a beef stew. But yeah, I had a dear friend who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, who lived in Garstang, a very small town in Lancashire, about half an hour from Blackpool.
Okay.
And and we had very authentic Lancashire hot pot when I was there. So yeah.
Actually, people might not realise, because I said about Lancashire and Yorkshire, because they're the two basic rivals, as in the War of the Roses. And
yes,
the Lancashire still do have the red rose, and Yorkshire have the white rose. And you can tell which side won, because the red rose is the emblem of England, still is. And I can even relate more to it, because the deciding battle of the War of the Roses was in my hometown of Barnet, where Warwick the Kingmaker met his end, and that was the deciding battle. So, small world, in a way, shall we say. But one of the things I've noticed over the last few years is the increase in female heroes, be it crime or adventure or what have you. And you, in your first book, Spitfire was your first book, I think, you introduce us to Livy Nash, one of these great female heroes. I want to say heroines, because it's like people say actors for men and women, not actresses anymore. I'm just not politically correct, I guess. But, so what got you round to, you know, to choosing a female as your lead character?
Well, you know, as most writers are, I'm an avid reader, and I read this wonderful book many years ago called Codename Verity, mm-hmm. written by an author named Elizabeth Wein, W-E-I-N.
Yeah.
It's actually a young adult novel, but I mean, it's only because the protagonists are 17 and 18 years old.
Exactly.
And it was the first time I'd ever heard of the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which is, you know, for those of you who don't know, it's sort of it was sort of amateur spies that were recruited by the British. It was Churchill's idea. They were trained and they were recruited primarily because they had language skills.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have, you know, if they were going to France, they might have French parents, and they could pass themselves off as a native. And they were given, you know, 12 weeks or so of spy training, breaking and entering, hand-to-hand combat, you know, parachuting. And then they were dropped behind enemy lines and doing these incredibly dangerous jobs. I had no idea that women were a part of that.
I can
a big part of it.
I can remember going back to sort of like the Sunday afternoon films we used to have when growing up, and they had, you know, a lot of the war films, you know, Dam Busters and Wooden Horse and all that. There was a film called Carve Her Name with Pride, I think it was. I think, and I'm not sure whether that had Cordette in it or Cordette was a similar one, but that was about one of these people who spoke French that were dropped in. And, you know, she was tortured terribly and stuff like that, and wouldn't give up the secret sort of thing. But yeah, so that, it was something that I knew about from, you know, way back. But a lot of people, as you say, just wouldn't realize that what there was. It's like the women who flew the Spitfires and the Hurricanes, not in war, but who delivered them unarmed. You know, just from the factory to the aerodromes while the Germans were still attacking and everything. And there they were, these women, just flying these unarmed planes from point A to point B, you know, without any defense. You know, it's amazing what where you get these people did in those days.
Absolutely. And I do want people to know the first book, Spitfire, is not really about aerial dogfights or anything.
No.
It's the name that the Germans actually give to, the nickname they give to Libby when she is working behind, you know, behind the lines in World War II, because she is a Spitfire herself.
Right.
The other definition of that.
Now, so, I mean, at the end of the book, were you expecting to make it into more of a series after Spitfire, before your new book came out, or was it? Oh, this has gone down good. Let's write a follow up.
Well, you know, publishing is a weird business. So when I wrote that, I thought, well, this character could certainly go on, because I'm certainly not the only, you know, author who has a female character in this sort of basic period. So I knew there was possibility for a series, but I actually wrote the second book before the first one was even published.
Really?
Yeah, and I wrote the second one as it could be a standalone, because at one point I didn't know whether the second one would come out before the first one, really.
Ah.
And fortunately, that did not work out that way. So when in editing Nightshade, I went back and sort of, you know, put in things from the first book for those people who read Spitfire, but you can still read Nightshade as a standalone if you want to.
Well, in Nightshade, you know, Livy is back, and she's lost a friend, you know, and this friend sort of disappeared or what have you, and suddenly Nightshade is the code name, isn't it, for this other person, if I remember right?
Yeah, right. Livy, who does not make friends easily, her best friend during the war is a woman named Margot DuPont, and Margot was like a lot of these SOE agents. They didn't come home. They were listed as missing, presumed
right.
dead. And so Nightshade begins with a wireless operator getting Margot's code name, Nightshade. You know, he hears it over the wireless one night on his shift, and so Libby has to find out if she's still alive, and if so, where is she, and what has happened.
Well, of course, the other thing is, you know, the Germans were pretty adept to setting traps with these passwords and stuff like that and code names, and she, you know, that would have been something I'd have thought she was a bit concerned about, whether it was somebody trying to set a trap for her.
Absolutely. Well, this is post-war. This is
1947. Okay, yeah, right.
And, but still, you know, Libby, who works as a spy under the guise of a foreign correspondent. You know, absolutely, that's one of their concerns. Is this real? Is it some sort of trap? But, you know, this is a spy novel, and as you can imagine, things are not always exactly what they seem. So.
And, of course, 47, you got the intrigue because the Russians, you know, coming from that side, then East Germany, and all sorts of stuff coming out the woodwork, I'd have thought.
That's right, right. And so in order to find out what happened to Margot, Livy, the English presume that she may have been relocated by the Russians when they swept into Germany at the end of the war. And so Livy has to sort of cozy up to a Russian agent who was so fearsome during the war on the Eastern Front that the Germans gave him the name Der Rote Teufel, the Red Devil.
Red Devil, right.
Yeah.
Wow. So she, I mean, and that's the other thing, you know, could she trust this Russian spy? You know, is there honor amongst spies even, I guess?
Well, you know, I think she is, I hope, a pretty resourceful protagonist, and so she doesn't trust a lot except herself, really.
Right. Yeah, because that's the big thing, you know, especially if you're there through the war part. Obviously, she was very reluctant to trust anybody because people trusted immediately you're putting yourself at risk. And it would have carried on after the war, especially something like this where you think this person's not there anymore. And suddenly, as you say, they're sort of, you know, their code is announced. And
right.
Hang on.
Well, the publishers like to give sort of taglines for books, you know, sort of one sentence kind of summations. Mm-hmm. And the one they came up with this one is, "How far would you go to rescue a friend?" And that really kind of is what driving Libby.
Right.
You know, is to, if her friend is out there, to get her back in any way. And this is actually based on something that actually happened. One of the books I read as research for both Spitfire and Nightshade is this book about a woman named Vera Atkins, who was the head of who worked in the French section of the SOE, and she recruited a lot of the women who went behind enemy lines in France. And after the war, Vera Atkins made it her mission to go to Germany to try to find out what happened to the missing so that she could give the family some closure.
Right.
And so when I read that, I thought, what if somebody was still out there, you know, a couple of years later after it sort of has died down and then, you know, the Nuremberg trials and all that sort of stuff is over. So that's where the idea came from.
Yeah, there was something I read. Oh, dear. Didn't read. Had an author on a couple of years ago. About 2 years ago, I think it was. And he wrote something a little bit like that. What happened was these people who hid in the woods in Poland and they sort of basically there's almost like a little village in these woods. These people just hid in there, you know, safer in there than sort of being put up in people's houses and stuff like that. And they were still there for a year or so after the war. You didn't know the war had ended and stuff like that. And you hear it with the Japanese, don't you, on these islands and that.
And
it would have been, especially for basically spies, they weren't exactly you know, treated with the Swiss, Red Cross, or anything like that,
they
disappeared, and that was it. Nobody cared or anything like that. There was no prisoner of war camp for spies, sort of thing. So you don't know what happened. So, I mean, after the after Spitfire, did you get a lot of response from that?
Occasionally you hear from someone who is, oh my gosh, you know, I like this so much. You should reach out to you personally. Mostly, you know, what the response you get are reviews on places like Amazon or Goodreads,
which
I do not read. I ask my wife Brooke to read all of them for me and tell me about the good ones. So that's the one main lesson I have learned of being a novelist is do not read your reviews on Amazon or Goodreads because it's just better if you don't. So I've had some great feedback from Spitfire and some early good stuff from Nightshade. Yeah, I've been really pleased.
What I was getting to go to was, you know, as people were clamoring after Spitfire for a follow up book, and now it's ready, and were they waiting for you, sort of thing? Sounds like they were.
I think so, and from the people who have read Nightshade, they are saying, you know, when is book three coming out? Because this book ends with something of a cliffhanger.
Okay.
Definitely an ending that begs a follow-up.
Well, there you are. That's the way to get them, isn't it? And they're turning the pages. You can't leave me like this. It's the next chapter.
I don't make people angry with that.
Right. No, that's it. Yeah. It's a fine balance, isn't it? It's like it always reminds me of the old Saturday morning pictures. You know, the serials. Live with the heroine left dangling from the cliff top or what have you. You know, you come next week. Oh, I've got to. Same with a book. If you can get a book like that, then great. And sounds like you've managed it with this. When you sort of go in, you said, you know, you've done a lot of investigation and follow up with about that other lady and stuff like that. Do you enjoy that part of it? You know, doing all the revising and everything for it.
Research. I mean,
research.
Yeah,
that's the word I was looking for.
Research. Yeah. At some point, as an author, you have to tell yourself, stop researching and write. You know, because I think writers are also great procrastinators.
Yes.
But the research is so fun, and my favorite part of the research is I made friends with a gentleman who is a French veteran of World War II. He's actually going to be 100 years old in February.
Wow. Yeah.
His name is André Rocher, and you know, so when the first book is set in mostly in 1946 Paris.
Uh-huh.
And so when I had, like, you know, a question like, were there payphones? How would you use the phone if you needed to and you're on the street? And I called up, email André or call him, and he would tell me, you go into a cafe, and you ask to use the phone. You know, he's a good friend and an absolute walking miracle as far as I'm concerned. He'd be 99 years old and has lived through the war, and his wife was in the resistance in Bordeaux.
Oh, right.
You know, it's like, you know, living history. It's really fun.
I mean, it's interesting. A lot of people are now, I reckon the last 4 or 5 years, something like that, a lot of people are taking what have been family stories, you know, from the war time period, etc., or their mother was in it and stuff like that. And always the family have told these stories. But people are now taking them and writing them, you know, putting them into a novel or just writing, you know, the stories, etc., like that. And we've had about about 4 weeks ago, a gentleman had written a book about his mother who escaped Russia, during the she was a white Russian, went to Japan when she was little with her father, who they captured a boat from Russia and got to Japan, and then having to sort of put up with Japan. And then when the Second World War started, she survived Hiroshima, whichever you want to say. And, and it had her story about that and how she then came to America and lectured about it and everything like that. And he said, I've just got to get it down before it's forgotten. And I think that's a lot of good, you know, what's happening, including sort of your book, which is reminding people of the sort of things that did go on.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to, I know you're not saying this, but to remind everyone that my books are fiction.
Yeah. Oh, no, I understand.
They have the big F on the side. But yeah. I mean, certainly with my friend André, you know, his wife who was in the resistance, she left a journal of her day-to-day activities. And last year, in a separate project, I got a grant and was able to hire a French translator, and so we were able to translate that into English because he has grandchildren and great-grandchildren who speak French. And so now, you know, we and they can read, you know, what their grandmother and their great-grandmother did during World War II.
And that's the sort of thing, you know, to do that. And yes, I know it's fiction, but the facts of what the environment was like, what, like you said, talking to André, etc., to know how to do this sort of stuff, educates people who wouldn't know. I mean, you show a kid a phone box, they have no idea, you know, let alone the English ones where you have to press button A or press button B and all this sort of stuff. You know, a rotary phone would stump them these days, you know.
Exactly.
So as we were saying, you've got the it leaves us in a bit of a cliffhanger. And so how's your next one going?
It's coming along. You know, publishing is a slow process.
Yes.
And so we're just right now kind of the publisher and my agent, you know, talking about the next one. So even as we speak, I am kind of knee deep in sort of plotting it out and getting it ready to let them have the first glance at it.
Because
I don't have a date yet for a publisher.
I was going to say,
publishing, so unfortunately.
Because I was just thinking what all this reminded me of. Of course, my brain. Growing up, my favorite author was W.E. Johns, who wrote the Biggles books, which, of course, would not be allowed to be out now because they're not politically correct. But Biggles was a pilot, First World War, and then into the Second World War, and was then a detective after that. And, you know, he had a lot of his books after that with, you know, the detective and spy stuff. And it's that sort of thing where you've got the person who, you know, does stuff through one part and then, you know, what happened afterwards and things. So that, I was trying to think how, what it reminded me of, and that's what it is. So, yes. You can still buy...
Well, you know, in that vein, you know, a main character in both books is Ian Fleming.
Right.
Who wrote, of course, the James Bond novels.
But he was a spy master. Yes.
He was during the war, and then right after the war, he went back to journalism.
Yeah.
And he does what he does in my books, which is run foreign correspondence for the Sunday Times and a few other
papers.
But Fleming himself said, and I hope this is true, that he said many of my correspondents were also spies.
Right.
And when I read that many years ago, and, you know, had read about the women of the SOE, I thought, wow, you know, I need to make Ian Fleming, you know, sort of Livy's M,
right.
You know, the characters in James Bond.
It goes back to my mind as well, it's Lord Baden-Powell, you know, the founder of the Scout movement, who was a journalist. And he was in South Africa when the Boers and the Boer War, etc., was going on. And he used to paint pictures of, I think it was butterflies or something like that, you know, to send back and everything. But these pictures, the butterflies, the spots and the stripes and everything that went on it, was how he'd transmit the information about the troop setup and everything like that.
World War II, and even though my books take place in the early Cold War, but the war is certainly a looming figure still.
Mm.
World War II was a heyday for crazy espionage.
Crikey, yes.
There's a wonderful author I just would love to recommend to everyone. He's British. His name is Ben McIntyre. And as far as I'm concerned, he is the gold standard for nonfiction espionage right now. He has written a terrific book about Kim Philby, the famous British director, called A Spy Among Friends. And I used one of his books for Nightshade, a book called Agent Zigzag, about a double agent named Eddie Chapman, because in Nightshade, Libby has to pretend to be a double agent.
Right.
You know, a double agent is being a person who is a spy for one country but pretends that they're turning their back on their own country and spying for a foreign country.
Indeed, yeah.
So Ben McIntyre is fantastic, and just some of the stories in his, especially wartime books, are mind-boggling. You know, that people were able to get away with this when much was on the line in World War II.
Yeah, here we are, whatever, 60, 70, 80, 70 plus years after the war, we don't know a fraction of the stuff that went on. I mean, and I don't suppose we ever will. I don't suppose we ever will. But, you know, as you say, there was so much going on, you know, especially like even in England because of the Irish, you know, spied a lot for Germany and stuff like that. It's a lot going on.
Certainly. Well, in the first book, you know, one of the fun things for me was, you know, there's a Russian agent who says to Livy, you know, we were allies in this world war.
Uh-huh.
Why can't we be allies now? And in Nightshade, that idea of the Soviet Union and the West being allies is a distant memory.
Yes, it changed, didn't it, pretty quick. It's great chatting to you about this stuff, especially, you know, when I can relate to some of it as well, even more so. But what I'm going to do now, anyway, Michael, is hand the show over to you so that you can tell everybody where people can find more about you and, of course, your books.
Terrific. Well, you can go to my website, mlhuie.com, mlhuie.com, and there are links for, you know, all the major sellers to Amazon, IndieBound, Barnes & Noble to buy both books. And also there you can find links to me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So follow me there if you'd like. And I would just put in a plug for, if you're going to buy either of the books, try to buy them from your local independent bookstore. They need you right now, and as an author, I want to support them.
Indeed so. Well said. Anyway, Michael, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. It's been really great chatting to you.
Great pleasure. Barry, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Well, there you go. My guest today, M.L. Huey. That's H-U-I-E. And we've been talking about, well, his two books. First of all, Spitfire, and then his new book, Nightshade, which is, of course, a Livy Nash mystery. Really interesting, and a sort of book that, well, as he says, it leaves you hanging anyway. But it's the sort of book and stories that a lot of people, all ages, all sexes, would enjoy. And really good. And I know I enjoyed Spitfire when I read that one myself. And, yeah, really interesting to hear how about things that are going. And we, as we say, you know, there's stuff that we still don't really appreciate that went on, that people put their lives at risk. And it, during the war, after the war, and after the war, as we were just saying, with the sort of Russian side and everything like that, a lot of it was going on those days. Anyway, that's it. I'll be back tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. It's Tuesday, isn't it? I'll be back tomorrow with a fresh guest. But until then, I have one thing left to say. Don't forget...